Hey everybody, welcome back to the Wisdom Tradition Podcast. My name is Alex, and today I have a very special episode for you. But before I go into the details of what we're going to be doing today, I just want to give you a little bit of an update on the channel and just what's going on with me. So it's been 5 or 6 weeks since I posted my last episode. I just had various things go on and did a little bit of traveling. And just had some personal experiences that have kept me away from my normal productivity rate. But everything is still set up to proceed as scheduled. And I'm hoping to pick up the pace again very shortly. And so I'm hoping this episode will catalyze that for me. And now I want to just tell you a little bit about what makes this episode special for me. I originally did the notes for this episode almost exactly 1 year ago. So on the video version of this podcast, I'm going to be sharing some of the handwritten notes that I have that I took alongside this, this episode. And, I guess I should tell you what the episode is. It's a analysis of one of Manly Hall's lectures, and it's on the topic of the divine feminine, which is something that we've been discussing in depth on this channel, including, most particularly in the last article that I've published on the series on Pythagoras that we've done. So part three of that is on the topic of the divine feminine, among other things, but it focuses very heavily on that. And so this episode is in many ways a commentary on that previous episode. So one of the things that this episode will do is it'll explain it in a little bit of a more simple manner than I think I've done so far. I've discussed the divine feminine as part of this complex series of arguments and series of concepts having to do with Pythagorean philosophy. And so here Manly Hall is really going to synthesize it and just give us the basic ideas about what's so important about the divine feminine. So you're going to recognize the things he says here if you've been following along in those previous articles. But if you have but are still working through it or still having trouble making sense of all the details, this episode should help guide you through what the significance of the divine feminine, and we're going to be going to it in numerous ways. So I've been sitting on this episode for about a year, and one of the reasons is because at the very end of the episode, Manly Hall makes a statement. He shares some details about a old prophecy of Nostradamus's, but really the prophecy isn't the main thing. The main thing is really him giving his... he discusses Nostradamus just as an excuse to really give his take on this period in time that we're in. This is one of the few instances, there's a few, but this is only one of the few instances that Manly Hall in his writings that I've found has discussed his thoughts on this particular time period that we're in, the early decades of the 21st century. So that's coming at the end of the article, but before then, we have this a number of clips that I've isolated out that's going to be rehashing and going over this idea of the philosophy of the divine feminine and how the divine feminine really fits into a trinity of father, mother, child. That's the divine trinity. And then the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost that we have in Christianity, that's like a secondary trinity. Or Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, that's a secondary trinity that exists in relation to this primordial trinity of father, mother, child. So the basis of understanding the divine feminine is to understand the primordial trinity of father, mother, child. And again, this is something that we talked about in the previous article, and we're going to be going in to more detail today on this episode that's analyzing Manly Hall's lecture on the topic of the divine feminine. So that is what's coming up. I'm excited to be doing this finally and to be sharing this with you. And I hope you'll stick around for the exciting conclusion, but I hope you don't jump ahead just to see what it is. So please just stick with the episode. I think you'll enjoy it. It's a great lecture of Manly Hall. It's one of his finest, in my opinion. And it was one that really came to me through synchronicity. It came to me at the exact right time last year to really help me at a stage when I was first putting together the ideas that would go into this article and to the previous series on Mahayana Buddhism. But I wanted to wait till the right time, and I feel like this is the right time, not only in terms of the series that we've been doing, but just in terms of things that have been happening in my personal life. I feel like this is the right time to put this out. So again, thanks for tuning in. My name is Alex Sacken. This is the Wisdom Tradition Podcast, and I hope you enjoy the episode. God bless. Okay, so now we're going to begin our analysis of Manly Hall's lecture, which is titled the feminine factor in world religions. And again, I have written notes for anybody who wants to watch the video version on YouTube. I'm also going to post these notes on my Substack for those who follow me there. Now, in this first clip that we're going to be going over is kind of an introduction to the lecture as a whole, and it's going to discuss the main topic, which is the feminine factor in world religions. Again, that's what the title is, so i.e. the divine feminine. But we're going to be understanding the divine feminine here initially in terms of its relationship to this primordial trinity of father, mother, child. And this trinity is conveyed in the Pythagorean system with this famous Pythagorean triangle of the 3-4-5 triangle. And that the 3 represents God the Father, and the 4 represents the God the Mother, and then 5 represents God the Son or God the Child. And so that this core trinity is the foundational one of creation, of the universe. So you might be asking, so if we're dealing with 3, 4, and 5, what about 0, 1, and 2? And to answer that, I recommend going back to this part 2 of my series on Pythagoras, because that episode and that article is entirely focused on 0, 1, and 2 and the meaning of those, and 3. So 0, 1, 2, and 3 are in that article, and then 3, 4, and 5 are in part 3. Now, on the topic of, this reminds me, on the topic of the article having to do with part 2, the podcast that I did for that episode, I initially uploaded the wrong file, and I didn't catch it until several weeks after when somebody was kind enough to email me. So I'm sure many of you have downloaded that and were confused by the fact that it wasn't what it was advertised to be. I had accidentally uploaded a Manly Hall lecture, but not my episode. And so I replaced the file. So if you go back and listen to part 2 now, you're going to get the right podcast. And so I apologize for any confusion that anybody had with that. But anyway, 0, 1, 2, and 3 are in part 2, and then 3, 4, and 5 are in part 3. And so this mystery of 3, 4, and 5 is what we're going to be going over again in this episode, looking at this core trinity of father, mother, child. So with that, I want to begin and play this initial clip from Manly Hall. So let's get started.
It might be interesting to study one of the most curious circumstances in religion, and that is the relationship of the feminine principle to the principal basic theologies that have descended to us from antiquity. I think we may point out with some assurance that the purely masculine concept of deity is comparatively recent. In other words, most of the religions of antiquity had an entirely different attitude toward the invisible spiritual worlds and realities behind physical existence. Nearly all of the ancient religions of the world were more or less religions of family. In other words, the deities were more or less inspired by the earthly social structure, the brood family, the tribe. The emerging society was always the basis of a spiritual conviction. In other words, the earthly family, the basic family pattern, the Pythagorean 47th proposition, is father, mother, child. This was the original Trinity, and has been so recognized for many thousands of years. In the mathematical formula of the Pythagorean equation, the square of 3 plus the square of 4 equals the square of 5. 3, father, 4, mother, 5, child. This concept has been sustained mathematically by philosophy for thousands of years. How then do we want to understand some of the points that have come up in the course of human change and evolution? Nearly all our religious thinking has been more or less rarefied to become the basis of our spiritual convictions. Society, more or less, regards itself as a symbolic unit. And this society has been extended upward to become the basis of a divine society. And the divine society of antiquity was merely a very rarefied version of human society. In the heavenly regions of the past, everything was based upon a family. It was not based upon a single deity. It was based upon gods and godlings and goddesses that were very human because they were based upon human archetypes. We find that the gods of antiquity had all kinds of problems. They had everything that we have on earth. They had the jealousies, they had the wars, the conflicts, the conspiracies that we associate with humankind. And these various problems became the basis of a concept of reality. A concept of reality in which the entire system of divinities was parental. The gods were the parents of mankind. These gods, to become parents, had to be parents. And each parent god, in one way or another, each deity, male and female, became parental as the fathers and mothers of mortals. The savior deities were the eldest sons of this parental family. The lesser divinities were some of them derived from subordinate religions. Some were merely an examination into the theory of relationships, uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters, children. But heaven was a family. And it was a family for thousands of years. And as such, was almost completely dominant among the religions of the world. This family of deity, this father, mother, child, became heaven, earth, and the underworld. It became the great triad of will, wisdom, and action. It became another great triad of wisdom, love, and service. Everywhere things were triadic. This is an archetypal plan, a program that has existed before the beginning of time. And above the rectified world is the region of the supreme family. That family which we call the Godhead. But this great good family is invisible. And this great good family is beyond the estimation of the human mind in all of its patterns. Therefore, this great family is interpreted by human beings according to their own families. And if the families on earth are in friction and are dishonorable, then the gods in heaven are said to be suffering from conspiracies. If there are griefs and grievances among the gods, it is because man, in his own image, has created their likenesses and bestowed upon them his own frailties and limitations.
All right, let's go over just some of the main ideas here. So he makes a few points. Number one, he revisits this idea of the primordial trinity, which we've already discussed, father, mother, child. And then he also talks a little bit about the origins in human life of this concept. And he talks about how in the earliest days when mankind was so simple, psychologically or intellectually, that there was no way he could misperceive the reality that was in front of him. So the original religion was one of this family concept. And then gradually as mankind evolves and grows civilization and builds cities and develops the ego and the intellect, the powers of the soul associated with sort of the cognitive system, the development of cognition, then we develop the capacity to make things really complex and to develop complex misunderstandings. And so based on these misunderstandings, we have moved away from this very simple but very true concept of the father, mother, child, or heaven as a family, a primordial family. And so one of the things that we're going to be talking about as we go on is to discuss how to return to that or to bring these old ideas back and in a new way. And one of those things that we need to do is just to understand how simple these ideas are and intuitive they are. Once we can sort of let go of false attachments that we have to the complexities of our current way of thinking, and to think as simply as our distant ancestors and their more simple but beautiful and true sort of nature philosophy, in which there was no room for these complex intellectual misunderstandings like we have today. So that's the basic idea. Next up, he's going to go more into the history of things and discuss the idea of the brood family, which is the original type of tribal unit, and how the brood family had practiced a religion that was based not only on this primordial trinity, but in particular revered the feminine principle, which is the principle that we're lacking in today in this over-intellectual society. So we're lacking the simple appreciation of this feminine principle. And the sort of very masculine, sort of patriarchal type of regime that Western civilization has been under for such a long time is a manifestation of this detachment from the origins of things, with this divine family and with this reverence for the maternal or feminine principle, the goddess. So we are going to be trying to revitalize that by, in this lecture, going over in several different cultural instances how this goddess and divine feminine figure is represented. And the focus is going to be on ancient societies, ancient so-called pagan societies. We're going to be looking at how this divine feminine was featured in their paradigm or in their cultural systems. And so we're going to begin the beginning with this idea of the brood family here in this upcoming clip.
This idea of the parental pattern goes back to the brood family, the original primitive unit of human existence. The brood family goes back to the cave dwellers. It goes back as far as we can find a scratching on the wall of a cave. Everywhere, the brood family was the ruler. And in every brood family, the mother was the leader. Our American Indians have exactly the same concepts. It was the same concept in Central and South America. It was the same in Egypt. And in most of the religions of the ancient world, the brood family descended on the side of the mother. In Egypt, the mother was the one who named, designated, and served as the ruler of the ruler. In Egyptian philosophy, Isis and Osiris, brother and sister, were rulers of the other world, and brothers and sisters ruled the material world. Everywhere this rulership was divided, but not in a sense of conflict, but because it was a family. And unless there was the male and female principle, there could not be the progeny. And in ancient times, the progeny itself was humanity. Buddha summarized the statement by saying that creation itself is a great commune. It is a commonwealth. It is a tremendous diversity within unity. It is the supreme achievement of supreme divine insights. It has been placed here and developed, governed, and ruled by the highest conceivable systems of ethics. And the human being is not capable in all cases of fully appreciating this or accepting it or understanding it. But it still remains, as Confucius pointed out, the supreme law, the supreme plan, the supreme symbol, and the ordered universe is the symbol of the divine power. Now, this divine power must manifest in many ways. It manifests on earth, it manifests in the heavens, it manifests in the smallest insect, in the minerals, in the plants, in all creatures. There are laws regarding existence. And these laws are absolutely equal, fair to all concerned, with no prejudice and no preferences, all things measured by integrities alone. And these integrities are the innate truths that were planted therein by the divine power in the fashioning of all things.
Okay, I'd like to make a couple of quick points here. He he makes the point that the mother or the feminine principle in the original brood family pattern was the leader of the male principle. He's going to go into this further down the line in a later clip. But he's just introducing the idea that in the traditional brood pattern family, the one that revered the father, mother, child principles, the feminine factor was intended to be the leader of the masculine energy. And we actually find this exact sentiment reflected in Jungian psychology with the idea that the anima is intended to be ruled by the animus. So the anima represents the feminine aspect of the soul, and then the animus is the masculine aspect. And so the animus is supposed to be following the anima. And the anima also represents the spiritual soul, and the animus represents the animal soul. And so this same dynamic in Taoism is associated with the so-called the way of heaven, because the anima is a spiritual soul in heaven, which is emanating its energies down into material creation to form the bodily self, the bodily person. And the animus is the principle of the soul that is animating that body. And so the animus is psychically or psychologically is connected with the ego. And then the anima is connected with the self. So the ego is supposed to follow the self and not to be its own independent ruler or anything autonomous from the self. It's supposed to be a receptive principle that's receiving these energies of the spiritual soul and converting them into service and love and action and wisdom and compassion. So it's converting and using them, but it's not supposed to act on its own. And so these ideas all come together because they're all related. So the ego is supposed to be receptive to the self, and the animus is supposed to be receptive to the anima, and the lower self is supposed to be receptive to the higher self, and this is how that pattern works. So he also just emphasizes here that creation is a great commonwealth and a community of life in this original conception, and that mankind or humanity as a macrocosm also exists as a great commonwealth and community, but we don't see it, and that's what we must learn to see. And so one of the ideas here is that re-embracing these very simple concepts of father, mother, child, and the divine feminine that is a part of that is the secret ingredient, but the very simple ingredient, but the secret one that has the power to break down these barriers of the not-self that keep mankind in competition with each other and fighting with each other. So to break down the walls of the not-self in order to reestablish the unity of self, there's this idea that humanity exists as a great commonwealth or community just as it is in heaven. And he also just notes that one set of laws govern both heaven and earth. And this idea of law is at the core of this mystery of the divine feminine, because the divine feminine really embodies this idea of the law. And the mind is the sort of conceiver of this creation. And so the concept, the archetype that it conceives becomes the law for the creation. So the feminine principle embodies the law. And the law, and so creation happens always within the law, kind of like the child always grows within the womb of the mother. This constant presence, this fixed, guiding, nourishing presence. If you follow the law, you get nourished by the energies that are flowing forth into creation through law. And if you break the law, then you cut yourself off from those energies. So these ideas are all coming together in these basic philosophical unfoldment of this father, mother, child concept. Next, we're going to unpack the Egyptian trinity of Osiris, Isis, and Horus, just to further go into this topic of this trinity, father, mother, child. So we're going to go, actually, beginning with this, we're going to go on kind of a tour and look at various cultural traditions of this primordial trinity. So we'll begin with Egypt in this next clip.
So in the beginning, we have a whole series of myths. The Egyptians, for example, had a series of triads. These triads were distributed through the nomes, or provinces of Egypt. But in substance and essence, all of these groups of deities were a family. They were always father, mother, child. And in the most famous of these triads, which came in the middle and later dynasties of Egypt, the great triad was Osiris, Isis, and Horus. Horus was the beloved sun, the symbol of enlightened humankind, and the intercessor. Also, Horus, as he grew up to manhood, became the defender of his parents. He guarded them. He took care of them. He interceded for the weaknesses of mankind. And before the throne of Osiris and Isis, the soul of the deceased was weighed to judge its virtues and its debilities. Isis was called the mother of mysteries. She was the leader of all the sacred arts. She was the leader of the initiation rites. She was the symbol, therefore, of the universal mother, the mysteries themselves. The temple was the symbol of the mother of mysteries. And all of those in Egypt who entered into the religions, and that involved practically the entire population, each one of them was the son of Isis. Each one regarded Isis as the great mother of mysteries. And she was the instructor, the informer, the savior, and the preserver. Most of all, she practiced the most supreme power in Egyptian philosophy, love. Because after all wisdom, after all strength, the great power of salvation lies in love. The supreme power in Egypt then was Isis. And she became the symbol of all that was good and important. Her son became the savior of the world. And in the great rites of Sais, in the now lost and forgotten temple in Egypt, the initiations were in front of her altar. And in the final case of the example of perfect wisdom, the veil of Isis was raised, and the initiate saw the image face to face. Now, this was the way Egypt lived for thousands of years, because it was necessary and important that the graces of life should perfect the strength. Strength was important, but useless if not motivated by love. And love was useless unless it was in kinship and relationship with reason and wisdom. Therefore, in most of these philosophies, the god of wisdom and the goddess of mercy were the actual rulers of humanity.
Okay, I'd like to go back over some of the points he made there, because this is an important section. So he really went deep on Isis as one of these symbols, these cultural archetypes that pertain to this idea of the divine feminine, or the mother or the goddess archetype. And notice all the different things that are associated with Isis. So we've talked about mind, and we've talked about the law and plan and archetype. But now we're also considering the idea of love and associating law and the plan and the archetype, which the mother personifies, as being, and their innermost nature, created out of love. But I want to point out just once more all the associations that go in with this divine feminine principle. And it'll take time for these associations to intuitively come to you, but they all are related. And so they're worth contemplating. And so I'm just going to note on my handwritten notes here, I said what you should take away from this section is that yin, or the feminine principle, is relatively superior to yang, which is the masculine principle. So again, in Jungian terms, the anima, or the yin principle, should lead the animus, or the yang principle. And then Mendenhall reinforces this notion, but when he says that strength is useless unless it's motivated by love. And but also, conversely, that love needs reason and wisdom to be correctly focused so that it can do its work. It can't be misdirected, so it needs reason and wisdom. So the yin and yang. All right, so let's get into our next clip. We're going to be now moving over to the Greeks and looking at this goddess archetype, and the divine feminine archetype in terms of Pallas Athena, who is on the... He mentions Pallas Athena is on the state flag of California here, but also on right behind me, the state flag of Virginia is also Pallas Athena. And Virginia, again, land of the Virgin, which it's ostensibly the Virgin Queen, but really it's this Virgin Mary or the Virgin as this feminine principle. And so, you can also look at Maryland as also reverence of that. And then he does mention District of Columbia here. And this is also referencing the divine feminine. And then upcoming later on, I have information, an episode, and documentary material that I'm going to be sharing that has to do with the District of Columbia as a landscape temple designed originally by like master masons to be a landscape temple patterned after Virgo. And Virgo is also the constellation. Virgo is the Virgin, which again, this archetype of the divine feminine. So there's a connection between Washington, D.C. and this divine feminine that kind of is hinted at here. And I also just want to point before I go on that I do have this episode from a few months ago that I would like to recommend to viewers who haven't or listeners who haven't listened to it yet. It is on America's Place in the Universal Plan. It's a Manly Hall lecture that I do a breakdown of. And the themes in that are going to be coming up again as we proceed in this book that I'm doing, that I'm laying out with these different series, article series, and lecture series that I've been doing. So, this book called "Philosophy: Its Origin, Purpose, and Destiny." As we go towards the end of it, we're going to be revisiting themes from that episode. And so, I just want to recommend that to those who haven't listened to it yet. Anyway, in this next clip, we're going to be looking at Pallas Athena as part of our tour of the Divine Feminine.
This brings us into another kind of relationship. In Greece, in the early days, there was no distinction, no peculiar emphasis upon the masculine as the symbol of all good. Zeus, or Jupiter, as he became in the Latin, was a kind of good-natured rascal, but not too much to be counted on. The great wisdom of Egypt was in Isis. The great wisdom of Greece was in the mysteries of Athena, Pallas Athena, the supreme power in Grecian culture. Athena was born from the head of Zeus. She was born by Vulcan, the god of fire, splitting the head of the supreme god and bringing forth Athena armed and helmed. She has therefore been referred to, rather facetiously, as the great headache of Zeus. But Athena was the mind. Athena was the intellect. Athena was the reason. And all of these were feminine attributes. Even wisdom, which was the keynote of Athena, was a completely feminine factor. Because true wisdom has to be built upon internal intuition. It has to arise from a communion between the individual and the divine power, a communion of love, service, and common understanding. Athena, therefore, armed, became the guardian of almost every important art and science. If it was necessary, by one reason or another, she became the defender of the faith. More likely, however, she was engaged in the arts. She was the goddess of schooling and education. She was the goddess of art and music and literature. She was the goddess of judgment and of law and of medicine. The great salvation of all things was entrusted to her because she was recognized as the actual manifestation of the divine power of Uranus and Cronus, the great gods of infinity. She was their product, born from them and of them, and everything that was good in nature was embodied in her by embodiment. So Athena not only became the guardian of many different arts and sciences, but she became the peculiar symbol of the International Bible Institute, and is found on practically all of the publications and writings of this group. She is also the Britannia of England, the Columbia of the United States. She is on the seal of the state of California, and she is found in all parts of the world as a mysterious sovereignty. a sovereignty of integrities and values. This goddess, therefore, became the Minerva of the Latins. And the Minerva of the Latins was given a particular instrument, a helmet. A helmet which, whenever she closed the visor of it, she became invisible. Therefore, she became the patron of secret societies and esoteric religions. It was always in her name. Zeus might be wandering about the earth on worldly affairs, but she was the guardian of the home, of life, of family, and of growth and integrity, nutrition, and internal wisdom, and of course, of compassion.
I just want to quickly interject and point out the association there with Isis, or the Divine Feminine, and initiation. And so now we're uncovering the meaning of why we often hear the phrase Isis, Mother of the Mysteries. And then Pallas Athena played that role in Grecian society, and different cultures had their own version of this myth. But that's the role that the Divine Feminine plays, is this the priestess of initiation, so to speak. And that's why in Masonry, and the initiates are called Sons of the Widow, which is the widow is again a reference to Isis. So this explains the background behind those terms. So I hope this is making sense. Now we're going to move on and touch a little bit on the Buddhist tradition of this Divine Feminine, something that we've gone into in our Mahayana series, particularly under the auspices of our discussion of Kuan Yin or Avalokita, which is the Bodhisattva of compassion and is the Buddhist equivalent to, in Christianity, the Virgin Mary.
Now, in the Orient, we have a similar situation arise in connection with the esoteric teachings there. We find that Mahamaya, the mother of Buddha, holds a peculiar position in the Eastern thinking. She died 5 days after the child was born, and therefore does not play an important part in the general theology of Buddhism. Only in certain respects. Actually, she became embodied in the symbol of the peacock, for the reason that the peacock was the devourer of serpents. And this was a very important symbol to the Eastern mind. And you will find that in a number of the symbols of the Immaculate Conception in European art, the Virgin stands with her foot upon a serpent's head. She is the overcomer of serpents or of evil. One of the most interesting symbols in Buddhism is, of course, that after Buddha's death, the body was placed in a magnificent wooden casket, the way in which it was usual to deposit bodies prior to cremation. And Mahamaya, the mother, came down from heaven to mourn for her son. And as she stood mourning for him, the casket opened, and he rose from the dead to comfort her. And she joined him in the worlds beyond. Now, this is that legend, but it shows where the interest lies. Also, in all Buddhism now, the Northern School, Kannon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is shown as feminine. Actually, she is represented as the mother again of all the good, all the wise, and all the noble. She is the one who brings the little lotus throne into the dying, to the dying Buddhist, and his soul is placed upon this lotus throne and carried to the other world. She is the intercessor for souls, the marvelous mother guardian of all orphans in any part of the world. Wherever a child is motherless, Kannon takes it for itself. These symbols go everywhere.
I just want to briefly point out that Kuanon is just another name for Avalokita or Kuan Yin. So he's talking about the same archetype there, goddess archetype from the Mahayana tradition. So next up, we're going to be looking at North America and see how this tradition manifested in the original Americas.
Now, among the American Indians, we have some very interesting parallels to this. We find that in the Indian system, the brood family is the unit of culture and unit of civilization. Whether it be one of these tribes that wandered about in the plains and throughout the country, or those more permanently located in the pueblos of the Southwest. The Brood family was always run in the same way, and the highest expression of it that we have has come down to us was the Great League of the Iroquois. The Iroquois League, or the first original and natural League of Nations, was the one that inspired Woodrow Wilson to attempt the creation of a League of Nations in the 20th century. But the League, the Great League of the Nations of the Iroquois, was a unit built for the glory of truth. And the building, the place where they met, was called the Long House. And the Long House was the one which was big enough to carry within it every living thing. It was the great house where all things lived in the one community relationship of family. Now, their various leagues had a political system that was so interesting that early in the development of it, sachems, or wise men from the Indian tribes, went to England at the request of the British government to explain their system of politics. And it was very, very simple. Each of the several tribes had its own senators, or congressmen, whatever you want to call them. They were the ones that became the representatives of the tribe. These congressmen or senators were elected, and the only members of the tribe that could elect them or vote was women. The men could not vote. They appointed the men, but they could not vote.
Okay, now having done a bit of a survey of how this divine feminine principle has manifested in various cultural traditions of the past, Manley Hall is going to comment a little bit on what has happened to bring us to a state where we have lost sight of this tradition, this original tradition. And so this whole discussion is setting the stage for us to be inspired to want to revitalize it today and to find a new means to bring this tradition back and make it real in our lives once again, make it real in human life once again. So that's what he's going to be discussing in this next clip.
Now, the religious principles that we have today are identical with those of antiquity. They are the same truth, so which there can be no escape. The victory of the invisible over the visible in every case, and the realization that the great truths flow down from causes unknown and unseen. We know these things, but we can't live them. We have a theology in which the ambitions take precedence over principles, wealth over integrity, and material power over spiritual values and life principles. So as just surely as the ancient world had its concept of the family, our modern world, more or less, has the concept of the family feud. We have inherited the complete feudal structure. And in order to prove that it was inevitable, we set up a war in heaven to make sure the same thing happened there. But we have no proof that this happened. We have only psychological convictions about it. The truth of the matter seems to be that we have merely shadowed our own shortcomings into space and made them seem to be divine laws. Actually, this is not the case. This is not real, but we have allowed it to become the common expression of our way of life. As we drop back into the earlier centuries in the presence of emerging countries and those that have not emerged, we realize that the further back we go, even in modern society, the more equality there is. Inequality is a modern fashion. It is something that has come up when the individual felt that he could afford to disregard a large part of his own structure. But back in the older and lower areas of culture, Men, women, and children work together on equal terms, each doing what is necessary to the preservation of society. Gradually, we have changed this pattern, but as we have changed it, things have become consistently worse. We are not advancing the way we should.
So having discussed the state of the world, I guess, the state of play of the modern psyche, Manly Hall is going to be talking about steps towards the future. How can we bridge the gap from now to the original tradition and synthesize those two into something that's new? And he's going to make the point that this process must begin by transforming our understanding of God from this masculine image to not replacing it with a feminine image, but rather understanding a nuanced conception of the Trinity. And in philosophy, remember, I say this all the time on the channel, the key is to triangulate. Every concept that you want to work with, you can never deal with as an isolated thing. You must always situate it within a triangulation of principles. And so this is true also with the first principles, with the original creation of the universe. We have to understand these processes always through this philosophic method of triangulation. So he is going to talk about how the restoration of religion should come not as a replacement of one thing with another thing, such as the masculine with the feminine, but rather to bring the feminine in as part of a nuanced understanding of the Trinity of the Father, Mother, Child, because each is vitally important to understanding the as he said in the beginning, the nature of the Godhead. So let's get into this.
I think the time is very much at hand when we will have to realize that God is not a bachelor, that he is not something all by himself, that God represents a symbol, and that divine symbol is actually what we call in Christianity a Trinity. It is three in one, one in three, and deity as a Trinity is Father, Mother, Child, a basic principle. It is the Creator, the Preserver, and the Redeemer. It is this actual family itself, with wisdom, love, and labor united in an absolutely indissolvable unity.
Okay, so now having diagnosed this idea of the Trinity as being a solution to our confusion in terms of religious philosophy, he's going to now focus in and hone in on the particular significance of the divine feminine, which is this element that's not represented in our current culture. We're going to be looking at what is the significance, how does this change the way we look at the world, and how does this change the way we experience religion? How is this divine presence made manifest in our lives? How do we interact with it? How do we come to know it? How do we come to experience this archetype? So that's what we're going to be getting into.
So here today, we're more or less here to pay honor to what is probably the world's most important single symbol, and that symbol is maternity. It is the symbol of that without which all things end, that which, if disregarded or perverted, destroys civilization. The fate of the world and the future of humanity, whether we realize it or not, is essentially in the keeping of women. Men can help them. Men can take from them certain labors that are difficult. But the ideals and principles of progress are feminine, and as such must be allowed to mature and develop, and the women themselves must recognize the divine birthright which they have, respect it, honor it, and live up to it.
So we talked a little bit about the importance of the divine feminine now with this symbol of maternity and all the other connotations that we've associated in this episode with it, with this principle, the feminine principle. Now we are going to look at the relationship between this feminine principle and love, which we've discussed already in that section on Isis, this idea of love as being an inherent aspect of the God in the form of the mother, so we can interact with this divine love and in that way experience an aspect of divinity in its quality of the feminine, the divine feminine. So there's love, and then we're going to be associating that with the heart doctrine. If you remember back into our series on Mahayana Buddhism, and the last section of that, I talked about the heart doctrine and the importance of opening the heart and how the heart is intended to lead the mind. So the heart is the home of this feminine principle, this love, and then the mind is like the anima. So it's like the anima and the animus, the heart and the mind. And so the mind or the intellect is supposed to follow the heart, which is this love principle. So that's what we'll be talking about here.
The mind is useless unless it is warmed by the love principle within it. Wisdom without love is fallacy. Strength without compassion is fallacy. Learning without love, or without leading to a greater faith in realities, is empty, is nothing to it. And we are living on this surface of this emptiness every day of our lives, and trying to make it seem as though it was important and useful. But the main problem is to keep the heart power dominant. Love and love alone can solve this problem. Nothing else can. Faith can be strengthened by love, and love can strengthen faith. Peace can be aroused by faith or become apparent through love and through kindness. Kindness was a very great power in ancient thinking, and we now consider it largely as a feminine virtue. But kindness is, according to Buddhism, is the next world teacher. The next world teacher is the Bodhisattva Maitreya. And the word Maitreya means kind or kindness. And it looks awfully much as though there is something very deep and mysterious in this ancient concept that was given to the world over 2,000 years ago, that the universal savior of the future must be kindness. Power, skill, war, no. But a kindness which causes the individual to have an enduring sympathy for the needy. Kindness which means to turn away all wrath. Kindness which means to be ever aware of the needs of each other, and ever forgiving of each other, and ever mindful of our own need for improvement. All of these things sum up into what we might term a feminine dominance. Now, this feminine dominance can, to some degree certainly, be shared equally by all men, because a man has perfect capacity to be kind, if he wants to. He can be thoughtful, he can be affectionate, he can be considerate, he can be a good parent, a good marriage partner, and a good child. These things are not denied him in any sense of the word. He is perfectly capable of defending the best things in life. But when they come along, and there is a challenge, and there is a matter which requires, or is assumed to require, masculine prerogatives, let him forever remember that it is love in him that must solve, that it is not the privilege of the man to go out and fight. It is not even his need to fight for the defense of a woman. Because if man and women come to their proper relationship, there is no longer a conflict. Each one supports the other in its needs and fulfillments, and does everything possible to advance the common good.
In this next clip, he's basically going to synthesize the essential teaching. So pay attention to this. This is basically the synthesis of the lecture. There's more after this, but just pay attention. Everything we've been talking about is going to come together in this relatively short clip.
So the churches, the mosques and the synagogues and the temples and the chapels and the shrines all have the same essential principle to work with. In every case, God has so loved humanity that it gave its only begotten Son to save the world. And that love of God is the mother of humanity. It is that love which is expressed and exemplified. Without that love, the act of creation would be sterile. But divinity has given the power of love to control all things. And the divinity itself is an androgynous unity. It is mother-father. It has to be both. It cannot be either alone. It is a power which is divided in us, but was unity in the beginning, and must again ultimately be unified in creation. Everything in the end must be governed by perfect wisdom, resulting in perfect love.
So now he's going to turn back to a critique and analysis of modern society and look at and consider the absence of this feminine factor. And he's going to suggest a course of action that is toward re-embracing this divine feminine by inspiring it to be embodied by the women of the world. So the women of the world need to wake up to their own power, their own divine power, the archetype that's within them that has been kept absent from our psychology. So we have this male imbalanced psyche. And so to bring in the female, not to replace it, but to rebalance the psyche, to bring in this the feminine energy back into the equation so as to balance the masculine. So he's going to be talking about that and giving, I think, an inspiring message to the women of the world to find their power, because only through this power will the world actually be saved, or will the rebirth of civilization actually take place. It has to come not only through this rediscovery of this the divine feminine, but also by this archetype becoming activated within the women of the world, for them to find their power and to assert their rightful place in the grand social plan. So we're going to be talking about that.
The main thing that the woman has to do is become better informed about the universal plan and the laws that govern it, to realize that her dignity in it has been neglected, that her conscious, active participation in the fulfillment of the universal mystery has been passed over too lightly. There is a responsibility in her that no man can ever carry. There is a responsibility in her that if she does not carry it, all humanity will suffer. Therefore, it is most important that her power be protected, that her vision be clarified, and that the true principle of compassion will guide her in her daily labors. This compassion will rub off. It will rub off internationally, interracially. Once people begin to think in terms of a natural respect for each other, the whole history of the world will change. There is no reason why that part of life which carries its greatest ideals should be powerless to take any positive effect in the situation. It is perfectly possible for women to end war. They can do it if they want to, because they have the majority. And they also have intangible psychological forms and instruments of achievement, which men do not have. They also have the possibility of visualizing and dreaming from within themselves, especially in the hours and days in which they are carrying life in their own bodies. They can dream of a world better than anything we know. And with over 3 billion of them to do it, why is it so slow? Why is all this not being done? Is it because women have not as high an estimation of themselves as men have of them? Is it because for some unknown reason they believe that love and faith are not strong enough to take care of hate? Do they believe that religion is too weak to work against economics and competition? Are they so structured that they believe that they can live in comparative peace with maybe a half of the world hungry? What are these things that are retarding the most powerful force we have in the world today? A force that has been neglected, a force that has not been brought into focus, a force against which almost every vice we know would have to fall. This is something that seems to be very needed. And it's very possible that the present trend, which is definitely a feministic trend, has this at the root of itself. This is the fact that can be and restored as it was of old. 5,000 years ago, women ruled the world and ruled nearly every institution of mankind. Now they have difficulty ruling anything, including themselves. It cannot go on like this. We have a tremendous force internally aware of the great need of love, internally aware of the importance of peace, internally aware of the fact that it does not want its sons to go to war and die. It does not want its daughters to fall into negative patterns that have no permanent value. These people can and should be the leaders of tomorrow. They should help us to make peaceful the lands in which we live. And our education for young women today should definitely include very definite training in idealism, integrities, and the highest form of the recognition of the dignity of themselves. That they are not second-rate citizens and never were. They have always invisibly, visibly, or psychologically ruled the world. Now the time comes for them to unite to make certain that a better world goes on than we have had up to the present time.
All right, so I just love every part of that message, and I hope you'll take the time to contemplate what he's saying there, because I think it's really beautiful and important. And now he's going to, having set the stage, he's going to talk about how imminent and how pressing the need is for this transformation. And then this clip is going to set the stage for the final clip, which is going to be in regard to this prophecy that I mentioned in the very beginning of this episode. So stay tuned.
We are now at a time when every situation that we know of has come to a dead end. We are not getting anywhere. Now, we are not going to achieve this by simply electing women to a public office. They're entitled to it. No one doubts it. But that's not going to answer it if they keep on running the way the men ran it. We're going to be right where we were. So the effort of a woman to succeed by being like a man is a dead loss to her and to the world. She has got to do the thing that she alone can do, and that is dignify the internal values of life. She is the one who must emphasize those basic spiritual values which are the substance of religion. While men talk about religion, and a lot of them try hard to live according to it, religion is probably the most powerful force in the life of woman. But this religion cannot be sectarian, it cannot be competitive or combative, it can't be constantly involved in internal strife and struggle. Religion must be the internal awareness of all people of the rules of the game. It must be the recognition of the essential reason for being here, and that is to come to understand the power that put us here, the reason for being here, and how we can fulfill the unfinished business of the ages. With this type of thinking, we're going to get somewhere.
Okay, and finally, at last, we come to the clip where Manly Hall discusses something I hope that we all have been waiting to hear from someone like him, from a sage like him, to offer us a glimpse of hope at a point when it seems like the hour is the darkest in terms of societal death and decay and collapse and all the wrong values emphasized and all of the wrong ideas valued, and all of everything symbolically to do with the Great Reset is at its nadir and awaiting that rebirth. And if we go back to the very first article on my Substack, which was on the Ukraine war, at the onset of the Ukraine war, I was inspired to write an article that gave my interpretation of the significance of this event in relation to the Great Reset and the coronavirus lockdowns and everything associated with those events. So if you remember, I'm not going to go into details, but if you remember at the very end of the article, I mentioned how I thought that the Great Reset was a symbol, and that the World Economic Forum and the groups like that who think that they're building a world that's going to be shaped in their vision, at the last moment, it's going to sort of crumble like ash, but not the world as a whole will crumble like ash. It'll be that vision and that paradigm that we've been in will die, and will, in its stead, will be reborn something that the vast majority of humans don't even know exists, which is the institution of the mysteries and the institution of Isis and the restoration of the divine feminine in the form of this personal relationship with the law, which is what the mystery is all about, is about teaching man the ways of the law. So at the very end of that article, I wrote that, and then immediately after writing that article, I conceived the book that I'm doing now, which is Philosophy, Its Origin, Purpose, and Destiny. And all the articles that we've been doing since that article in Ukraine and the earlier part of this year, all that was inspired after I wrote that initial article, because I was like, okay, well, now I need to explain what I meant by that. What is this hidden institution, the secret institution that's been quietly waiting to assume its rightful leadership, its sovereign rulership over mankind? And it's this institution of philosophy. And remember, if you disambiguate that word, it means love of Sophia. And Sophia, again, is this wisdom principle in the form of the mother, or this intelligence, this law, and this quality of love. So, keeping in mind everything that we've been discussing over the course of this video, I want you to hear what he has to say, and then I'm not going to have any further commentary. I don't want to tell you what to think about it. I just want you to be thoughtful and to consider the state of the world that we're in now, and consider the optimism of what a better tomorrow might look like, what it might entail, what values, what principles do we lack today that might come into the future. So when we hear a prophecy that's talking about something good that might come in the future, the coming of a transformation in consciousness, now that we've gone through all the details of what that means and how the masculine must be balanced by the feminine, we can get a sense that what he's talking about here in this next clip is having to do with the restoration of the divine feminine and with a new class of leadership, male and female, that will arise to embody this new tradition and to establish the framework of a new civilization that is incorporating this balancing of forces, and which reveres God in the form of the Trinity and is embracing not only God the Father and God the Son, but God the Mother. So with this, I conclude the episode. I hope you enjoy this last clip. It's something I've been sitting on again for a year, waiting for the right time. And I feel like this is the right time. So God bless. Thank you very much for following everything that we've been doing so far. And I hope you'll keep checking back in and following the story either on this podcast or on the Substack or on my website or YouTube or any of the resources that I've put together. I hope you'll keep following this story and will want to be a part of it as it progresses in the future. So anyway, thank you very much. God bless.
But here we come. And I think Nostradamus was one of the prophets who pointed out that near the end of the present century, there must be a great and major change. That it may be preceded by a great cataclysm of some kind. Maybe not. He hoped it wouldn't be. But the world wasn't going to end, because he says that at the beginning of the 21st century, the paraclete will come. Now, the word paraclete means the peaceful. There is going to be a resurgent of life in which the divine plan and the divine purpose will be restored. It will be a time when all governments and all ways of life will begin to pay honor and tribute to the immutable principles upon which existence stands. And at that time, the Prince of Peace, or the Princes of Peace, may come. But whatever it is, the great change is one thing and one thing only. It is the change, the shift, from fear to faith, from hate to love, and from error to truth. We cannot build on any other foundation. And of all the values that we have that we need most, these values are associated particularly with women. This whole world is a garden. And if we stop wrecking it, we can have it. There is no reason why utopia shouldn't be a reality. There is no reason why people who can educate themselves into all the skills that we have cannot further that education until they reach the condition where they can live together in peace. All these things are coming. And when the times and decisions arise, it'd be wonderful to know that we got a solid vote of confidence from the women of the world, and that they're going to stand up and say, this is the way it must be. Not because we order it that way. Not because we're going to carry the munitions or going to get hold of the bombs. But because there is something stronger than all these things, and that is simply love. And that is the particular power with which women have been endowed by the universe and by God. And by using it, they will discover that the love of God is the love for God, and that all together we are one creation, trying to think it through from a man's standpoint, trying to feel it through from a woman's standpoint. Bring the thought and feeling together, and we got something.